that SPP had asked to move the timing up from 1:30 to 1. Sam, is that still the case? I don't have any objection. Does anyone else have objection? These are scheduled for an hour and a half each, this one from 10 to 11:30, although we're starting a few minutes late, so we recognize that. And the other one was scheduled for 1:30 to 3. Does anyone object to changing the SPP update this afternoon to 1 to 2:30?
That works for me.
Okay,
from when?
From 1 to 2:30.
It starts at 1:30, so it would be changing from 1:30 to 1, like the start time.
Okay, sure.
Okay. We will do that. And Steve, if you could send a message to John, there's another meeting scheduled for 3. We can move that to 2:30 then, I presume, right?
Yeah.
Have John change that to 2:30, please. Okay, with that, Brian, are you going to...
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start us off.
SPP. Everyone, by the way, for the recording, I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krashes and Julie Fedorchak. At the table, we have Jerry Lehan and Victor Shook. And I'll let you introduce your team and a good crowd in attendance here today. But go ahead, Brian.
Great. Thank you very much. I assume Green is live here. Very good. Thank you. I'm Brian Tello, again, Executive Director, External Affairs for MISO's North Region, based in the Twin Cities, and really appreciate the opportunity to come today. And I really have to start by thanking Commissioner Fedorchak for her service on our OMS, because I know some of this you will have seen before. I'll apologize in advance for that.
All right.
Appreciate your service there, and appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk today. Let me introduce my colleagues that are with me. We're in order here, and I'll do it with the agenda also that you have on the screen right now.
Okay.
I'm going to kick us off and just talk about the evolving MISO portfolio. This is a bit of a setup for the two topics that follow, but talk about some of the changes we'll see in our portfolio. Those two topics that follow are resource availability and need, and Laura Rauch, to my right here immediately, is one of the two very bright young engineers that we brought with us today to help us explain some of these more technical issues. She's the director of resource adequacy, I believe, and manages the area around resource availability and need, where we've got a lot of activity going on right now, and we'll do an update on that. And then Arash, next to Laura, is our manager of resource interconnection, and he's going to talk about the interconnection queue and the challenges and trends that we're seeing there, because that, more than anything, probably points to the direction things are headed out there. And then at the end, Alice and I are going to tag team kind of catch-all topic around transmission planning, which was a big topic at our board meeting, which we had last week, and cost allocation, which is always a big topic and is actually coming, we think, to a close after about a two-year debate there. So we'll talk about that a little bit and give an update there. So let me start back on the evolving portfolio. This is the obligatory page. It just explains where MISO is. I think everybody's probably seen this and heard this pitch a little bit. So this is a bit of a reminder. We describe ourselves as the coast-to-coast RTO, because we stretch from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to the Hudson Bay in Manitoba. Mm-hmm. And Manitoba is shortchanged on this map a little bit, because if we put them on there, then everybody else is hard to see. But we do have a broad footprint, and that breadth is a strength in the RTO world. The diversity is the key. And we've got it in droves, 15 states, 42 million customers. About $27 billion flows through our markets every year, so we track that. 175,000 megawatts, over 180 members, and many more market participants on top of that. So that's the basic backdrop. But if you take that blue area that represents MISO's footprint in the middle there and turn to the next page, I wanted to start with just a grounding of what the generation mix is currently and where we think it's headed is basically where this discussion is going to go. So if you take that blue footprint, that's the MISO footprint, and look at two things. First, the capacity to generate electricity in the first pie there in the middle of the page, and then the electricity that's generated by that capacity. Obviously, those are two different things. One is the capacity to generate electricity. The other one is actually how much energy is actually generated. So we've got megawatts on the left and megawatt hours on the right. But if you look at that, you can see that we do have a diversified portfolio that's about a third coal from a capacity standpoint, but about half coal from an energy generated standpoint. So coal is still playing a very significant role on our grid. The other thing I would call out is nuclear, because coal and nuclear are similar in that they both have a capacity share that's smaller than their energy share, right? They tend to operate a lot more hours, so that's why that's the case. Gas and wind are the next two segments I would talk about, and they're the opposite. Their energy share on the right is less than their capacity share on the left, so they don't operate as frequently. Both wind and gas are in that category. But you can see the amount of, we do have a lot of gas on the system. It's the biggest type of generation by capacity on our system. And we do have an increasing amount of wind, about 14% by installed capacity, that generates between 8 and 9% of our energies today.
So that wind number, that's not accredited capacity, that's just...
Right. It is not accredited capacity. But that's a good question, because when we look at some of the things we were going to talk about later around reserve margins and things like that, that accreditation point, because you're right, we don't count wind very much when it comes to that. And Laura will probably get into a little bit of that. Okay, so if you take that electricity generated, and normally when you see these pie charts by RTO, they are the energy generated, and carry that to the next page, repeat it there on the next page. I wanted to drill down a little bit into just what this region looks like from an electricity generation standpoint. And within MISO's vernacular, this is Zone 1, the northwestern part of MISO. You can see the boundaries there on the map. And the mix there is a little different. It's about the same from a coal standpoint, about the same mix. Thank you. But a lot more wind. And a lot less gas is probably the biggest way to characterize the differences between this region and MISO overall. So you can see those numbers on the right. Now, if we now take a different cut on this, and I apologize, the things that are normally green on our graphics and on your handouts are going to show up a little bit light here, so it's a little bit hard to read on the screen, but everybody should have a copy in front of them. Just recognize that the green will be a little bit hard to see. This page repeats in the middle of the page the 2017 energy mix that I just talked about. You see the 48% coal number there in the energy mix. But it tries to put this in a historic perspective. So if you look backwards in time from 2017, you can see that mix in 2005 was very different. Back in 2005, and the footprint had a different shape, a very different shape to it then. But we were more than three-quarters, almost 80% at times, coal generation. So there's been a pretty dramatic shift 2005 to 2017. 2005, the renewables didn't even show up on the picture. So big changes between 2005 and 2017, and we think that trend of relatively significant changes is going to continue. So on the right-hand side of this page, we show our various future scenarios from our transmission planning process. And we don't plan resources, generation resources. We plan transmission. But to plan transmission, we have to have a view. We have to test that plan against various scenarios of where the resources are, because where the resources are and the types of resources are an important aspect of where we need transmission. So we do that with a scenario-based planning process that comes up with different possible views of the future, none of which is meant to be the particular one we think is the right view of the future. We don't try to do that. We try to develop bookends, if you will, to evaluate different transmission projects to make sure that they are robust under various scenarios. In other words, you wouldn't a project that's helpful in one scenario but is would have been a regrettable investment in a different scenario is something we would shy away from. The best transmission projects are helpful to the grid in all scenarios, and that's what we look for. But you can see the different scenarios that we lay out there, the limited fleet change, continued fleet change, and these are almost degrees of change generally as you go down the page, and then accelerated fleet change, the third one. The last one is a little bit different because it's a little bit more focused on the distribution side of things, which still affects how we do planning. My takeaways from looking at all these scenarios, though, as we think about the future, are that we do see coal going down, which probably isn't a big surprise, but we certainly don't see it going away. I mean, we still see it at least 30% of the energy mix in 2033. So it's certainly there, an important aspect of things. And really the big things these futures vary on is just how much renewables penetration do we get between then. And then it becomes kind of a battle between renewables and gas more than anything else, because the coal percentages don't vary that much between all the scenarios, is my view of this. But
so, Brian, when I look at these, the percent of basically traditional base load doesn't change significantly, except for, so it gets to be the least in the accelerated fleet change, looks like, but
right.
Otherwise it tends to be about where it is today.
Little less than what it is today, but still in the, you're adding coal and nuclear, I assume.
And gas?
I mean, okay.
Well, I know it's, but
yeah, cause
I guess
gas is not
a
category.
I should say base load. I'll call it dispatchable.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so when you look at the sum of those three, it looks like they vary between about 60% and about 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when Arash talks, he will be talking about the generation interconnection queue, and you'll kind of see one of the big drivers for how these things are trending, we think. But these are the planning scenarios that we evaluate the annual plans we developed.
Brian?
Please.
Does anybody ever look back to 2005 and have some records or recordings of what you were predicting for 2020 and see how close we're tracking?
I'm sure that would be doable, but I don't recall seeing any analysis on it.
I'd be curious at how effective the RTO has been.
This is where I'm going to get in trouble for bringing two engineers with me.
A decade and a half out.
I was actually part of MISO transmission planning in 2005, and a lot of what we were talking about there was increases in coal at that point. As time has gone by, it's evolved, and for a while we thought nuclear was going to be the fuel of the future to replace these, and events have happened that changed that and shaped that. State policies, also federal policies, especially around emissions, and even events like Fukushima have changed and swung the predictions of MISO and stakeholders that we reflect in these models. So if you looked at 2005, you would have seen a much larger fraction of coal growth expected. And then that's since evolved as state mandates have come out and as emission standards have become more rigorous.
Yeah, and the big change between 2005 and now is gas prices, too. In 2005, 6, and 7, we had some really high gas prices, and predictions were that prices would stay in the $8, $9 per MMBTU range. And at $8 and $9 MMBTUs, coal is a much more economic option than gas at that point. So that's why you don't see much gas at all in 2005.
That's about what I was expecting was the case. And so I just think it's important to keep in mind. We can have really smart people but not be able to foresee all the things that are going to happen. We don't live in a static world. In fact, our world is probably becoming less static all the time. And so to think that these predictions are necessarily what's going to be the situation in 15 years from now is very confident.
Yeah, and I probably didn't make the point very well. I don't think any of these futures are going to be the one. We hope we've got the future bookended with some extremes, but we may not, because there are gas price assumptions embedded in all these. And if gas prices, you know, defy the economics and go back up to $10 an MMBTU for a sustained period, then I don't think any of these things on the right would be correct.
You're talking 15 years, but what is the gas price assumption, if you can? I mean, does it basically follow inflation rates between now and then? Does it move up above inflation?
Yeah, so the base gas prices that we use is reflective of what the current year would be. So if, you know, 2 years ago when these futures were being developed, the base gas prices were sitting around, you know, $3 to $4. That would be the base point, and then you would apply the inflation to that to predict what the outcome would be in a 5, 10, 15-year time frame.
Okay, so no wild market swings related to supply and demand, et cetera? Just more of an inflationary approach?
Yes, and again, as Brian indicated, you know, on an annual or biannual basis where we go through these future development process, which is a stakeholder-driven too, we take into account all the kind of activities that are taking place. So if at time gas prices are high, we try to develop a future that reflects higher gas prices. So we've been through that exercise in the previous years as well.
Do you have any scenarios if gas prices would double, for example? Or will we get into that and I should quit asking questions for now?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Not under the current future scenarios.
Or rise by 50%.
Yeah, so
above and beyond.
Sure.
Inflation.
So 5 years ago, we did look at different scenarios where gas prices would, say, increase by 50%. What would that look like? But just based on what we've seen and the feedback that we've received from, you know, various sectors through MISO, is that kind of we're going with the gas prices being as what they are today.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the indication. But
yeah.
But in 2034, natural gas will overtake crude oil at that point, I believe it is, as the top fuel source in the world. So I think it's going to have at least some bearing on price above and beyond.
You know, absolutely.
Moving it above and beyond projections, just the rate of inflation. But that's why these numbers are fun, right?
Sure. Yes.
Speculate and do what-ifs all day long.
Yeah, but those inflation-based sort of gas prices are consistent with market forward curves now too, so people are trading on that number. So I think it's a valid number. Of course, the future can always be different.
Yeah. No,
so I suspect we do some sensitivities around that. You know, to the extent it's not embedded, but we'll get you information on what the gas price assumption is for each of these, because I know we have that, and then whether there are any sensitivities that are run on top
of
that.
Thank you.
Okay, so moving on with some of the other trends that we see in this evolving portfolio, an important one, and I apologize again here for the colors, because the green, if you watch the Seattle-Minnesota game the other night, this is kind of what it looked like, right? A frightening color. But the frightening color there is the actual reserve margin that we experience in a certain year, the higher percentage. The blue line is the planning reserve margin requirement. In other words, what we feel like we have, the minimum we have to have from a reserve margin standpoint. So to us, what's interesting about this page is how these lines are starting to converge a little bit and come together. And that is the trend. They are coming together. There used to be a big gap, a surplus, if you will. The difference between the blue line and the green is a surplus in capacity, if you would. And we were blessed with a surplus in capacity for the early 2010 through 2014 and 15. And we've still got a surplus, but that surplus is shrinking right now. So if you look at the final year of this projection here, 2018, the difference between that actual reserve margin of 19.1% and the planning reserve margin requirement of 17.1 is 2%. And that's still a comfortable surplus. It translates into about 3.9 gigawatts or 3,900 megawatts of capacity, so 3.9 gigs of surplus, which is a pretty good surplus. Now, if we go to the next page.
So back on that page.
Sure.
Why did it drop so bad from 13 to 14?
In short, a lot of these are just the changes in the fleet. A lot of the drops in that time frame was assumptions around how much we can import from PJM. Early years, we expected to be able to import all of their capacity. In the 2013-14, we started to limit what we could import to non-emergency resources from them, and that resulted in less interchange into MISO and so more resources needed internally.
I was going to guess the Entergy integration, too, because that 2013 is about when we integrated Entergy for the first time. So that changed the size of the footprint and would have changed the mix. Also.
And is your goal to – is this intentional? You're okay with this to some degree because the excess reserve margin is excess cost?
We're okay with 2%. We're not okay if it gets
to exactly the required reserve margin.
Okay. And that's where I'm going on the next page. Okay. Actually, it's headed down, unfortunately.
Is the reserve the planning reserve margin requirement? Is that your own internal MISO requirement, or is that NERC's recommendation?
It's not a NERC number.
So it's a MISO study. There's no NERC requirement that says you have to have a certain amount of reserves.
But they have a recommended amount.
They in general we use kind of the standard, which is a loss of load of 1 day in 10 years. And that's you've seen that in most areas. That's what is used across the board.
Okay. So for 2018, 2% and 3.9 gigawatts of actual capacity. So if we look at that, the first number on this next page starts with that 3.9 gigawatts of surplus capacity that we have in 2018. And walk forward to what we project that number to be for 2019. Okay, so the left-hand side of the page starts with 3.9 gigawatts. The right-hand side of the page shows the 2019 forecasted regional surplus, which is down to about 0.6 gigawatts. So it's still above our planning reserve requirement. That's a good thing. But it's shrunk pretty dramatically. And we think it's instructive to look at what's causing it to change between 2018 and 2019. There were some forecasted load reductions, that actually helps. The load reductions makes it easier to hit, so that's a positive. There was a pretty good size negative, though, 1.4 gigawatt size in the due to higher forced outage rates. It's a little counterintuitive to understand why forced outage rates would affect this, but if forced outage rates are higher, then we put more risk on the units. And say, well, we need more capacity because that capacity is not as reliable as maybe we thought. Forced outage rates, which are the sort of unexpected outages, are coming in, and that means that capacity is less likely to be there, so we need more reserves.
So a forced outage lowers any unit's capacity rating?
Yes.
So then you need more units?
Right. You need more capacity.
So
right.
If it's a 100-megawatt unit and it has a forced outage, maybe the accreditation was 90, the next year could be 80 or whatever.
Yeah. That would be a big change, but yes. Yeah, that's the direction this is headed. And Laura will talk.
And the forced outage rates, is that aging infrastructure? What is it? People underperforming?
It's a lot of factors. We think it's predominantly the aging assets. I mean, that's the trend over time. We do see that trend being more pronounced in the south part of our footprint, where they have a lot of older gas steam units, not CCGTs, but old gas steam burners. And they are older, and they're not getting as much investment as they used to. So as far as maintenance capital and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we think that's the reason for the trend.
And does this look differently on our zone?
In our zone, or in your zone? I shouldn't say our zone. Your zone? Actually, the forced outage rates have not changed that much.
I mean, but the forecasted regional surplus is our...
This is footprint-wide.
Yeah.
And we also do this and can show it to you on a zonal basis. Mm-hmm. Generally, this zone is more flush with capacity than other zones. And the only zone that looks really, really tight, and the zones are interconnected, so, you know, this is considering imports and everything like that. This is Laura's world, so I should let her answer this question.
You're doing fine.
But Zone 4 in Illinois is the one that's the tightest. The one that stands up is the tightest. Mm.
So the old map region is carrying the rest of it?
In general, this area has generally exported. We are seeing across the board the ability for any area to export getting smaller in time, but we're not seeing Zone 1, this northwest corner, where you don't have enough generation to serve your load.
Then the last two.
Would you explain the forecasted load reduction? 1.5.
The United States overall is basically seeing flat to declining loads, peak loads I'm talking about. There generally is some regions have increasing energy demand in aggregate consumption, but the peak loads, and this is all a look at peak loads, right? It's not really looking at aggregate energy. But from a peak load standpoint, the country and the MISO region have not experienced load growth. And
in fact, are declining?
In fact, there are some declines, yes. Okay. The last two numbers, the 1.2 green and the 4.6 red, to show you there's more resources leaving the grid than are coming into the grid. Okay. Now, here, new resources that are wind would be put in at their accredited capacity, which is, you know, tends to be in the range of, what, 15%?
15.
Okay, all right, thanks. But keep me honest. So net-net, that number is 0.6, and then the process, I should have given credit to the OMS survey here, because a lot of this data comes from the survey that we do jointly with OMS, because it's really the best way to get people's view of how firm some of those resources are. But that cycle for 2020 will just be kicking off here in a few months, right?
Yep.
So we'll get a view at 2020 and see where that's at soon here too. The next page I wanted to touch on is also kind of a precursor for what Laura's going to talk about. But it's making the point that to get through some of these periods of tightness, as we get tighter as a market, we are, you know, looking at particularly that resource mix that's out there and what we rely on. And what we rely on from a resource mix standpoint on peak, so these are accredited capacity numbers in the pie on the left. It shows the accredited capacity for the different types of resources. That's why you see wind is only a very small portion of that, 2.3. But we wanted to point out this red section there, which is the demand response and behind the meter stuff, which is demand response programs, behind the meter generation, distributed energy generation, all those words are applied. We lump those under the umbrella phrase of load modifying resources. So this is changes that are more on the load side of things than the resource side of things. And there's a lot of them out there, about 12 gigawatts in this last cycle. One challenge with a lot of those, though, is that we basically have to be pretty well into our maximum generation emergency procedures to really access those a lot of those contracts. And Laura will talk about the character of those, but a lot of them tend to be older utility contracts that haven't been used much, haven't been needed. I mean, we've been flush with capacity for a long time. Now we're getting into situations, and it's not always in the summer when we have those situations. In fact, that's a trend here that we're seeing tightness in shoulder months and things like that. And some of these LMRs are not available, you know, because if they're demand response and there's the air conditioner is not running, then it's not there. So one trend we wanted to make sure everybody's aware of, and it's the whole reason we're talking about, one of the main reasons we're talking about RAND next, is that those LMRs are a very significant cog in us sort of covering the capacity.
Can you give us an example of more examples of the LMRs and how the utilities have contracts with them? Like, where are those visible?
So LMRs, or load modifying resources, generally are split into two categories: demand resources, which are load reductions, and those can be anything from aggregated Walmarts to even retail reduction programs. Typically, those tend to be more summer-focused than anything.
So they have tariffs that allow them to be kicked off?
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah, and really are governed by their tariffs.
Interruptible rates.
Yeah, interruptible rates, absolutely. There also are behind-the-meter generators, which are generators that are really meant to serve load and can produce some output on the MISO system on the distribution side. And those account for another share of those. Again, generally governed by retail contracts and different provisions. So we'll talk about that a little bit more, but one of the things we're aware of is it's somewhat like snowflakes. Each load modifying resource is slightly unique, but at the same time, they all share some common characteristics. So we want to recognize that and work with stakeholders on transparency.
And if there's 12 gigawatts of those, what's the peak, the total peak?
So it's roughly 9% of our total peak needs are served by these emergency-only resources.
So when you start getting short, at that point your energy market prices are up, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so most of these interruptible resources have likely been interrupted by the utility already, right?
So that's one of the things we want to work on gaining transparency. We certainly have found that sometimes in emergency conditions, utilities have already pulled some of these levers. Yeah. But that's not true across the board, nor is it necessarily true that we have transparency that utilities have done so. So that might be actually a great transition to start talking about RAN a little bit more. And first of all, I would just like to thank you for the chance to come and speak to you today. So as Brian so kindly introduced me, I am very young. Any day that it starts out with me being introduced as young is a good one, but my team is responsible for really supporting states and load-serving entities in making sure that we have enough generation to go and meet our load and risk factors. So we work with our stakeholders, especially OMS, to make sure that we have transparency on needs and also that the processes work. And as Commissioner Fedorchak said, as we get to a paradigm where we basically have the right number of resources and just enough resources to serve load, that's a spot that is what we really plan for. But it is a new operating paradigm. And the question really shifts from how do you build resources to how do you use the resources that are built when you're at that margin. And that's really the premise of resource availability and need. Resource availability and need is looking at the operating conditions we're in and talking about some of the gaps we've experienced and how we can make those better in the future. So and as I go through this, as we've been doing, please stop and ask any questions you might have. starting out just with the why are we focusing on this? We've had an increasing number of emergency events over the last couple years. In fact, if you look over the last 2.5 years, we've had 19 emergency events, either in parts or all of the footprint. If you look at the few years before that, we didn't have that many. So that's really illustrated a continued focus on what levers do we control and what else can we have. And what we've seen of those emergency conditions is we've managed through them through cooperation with our neighbors, through the use of variable resources such as wind, and also through relying increasingly on these emergency-only resources.
Laura, how many of those emergency events occurred in the southern part?
So if you look at the it's the black and the yellow really differentiate between the footprint-wide versus the subregion. So the yellow are primarily focused in that south region. The black are footprint-wide. So we have had a number of events that are specifically for the south, but we've also have some that extended to the entire footprint. So as we talk about the likelihood of and use of emergency resources, these are resources that when we set up our contracts, it was in our resource adequacy portfolio, we wanted to allow all resources that were used by load to continue to do so. So we set up rule sets that defaulted to kind of the minimum requirements for these. So between demand resources, between load modifying resources, there's a lot of different characteristics, and our tariff requires that those be available within 12 hours. And what we found is that there are a wide variation in resources that can respond and give us responses in that, but we have quite a large amount of those that really require 6 to 12 hours of notice before they're able to be used. We also only require those resources to be used to serve MISO load during summer peak capacity emergencies. And so you combine a focus on the summer with a 12-hour notice time and try to align those with the events we've seen, and they don't align very well. So we've seen actually a lot of these resources voluntarily offering themselves in to support spring or fall events, but it's not necessarily a requirement, nor do we have transparency when we're planning for the next month on what the amount of resources which might be available from a behind-the-meter or demand resource point of view for those emergency events.
So you have a lot of resources, you just can't access them without declaring an emergency.
Yes. And without declaring an emergency and the case of many resources, then waiting until 6 or 12 hours after that emergency has begun. Mm-hmm. And...
But in most of those cases, I mean, you might not know a year ahead or a month ahead or even a week ahead, but don't you usually see that coming 6 to 12 hours ahead?
And so that's one of the things that we're working on is using that transparency we have to more efficiently call on those resources. So we actually have a proposed solution which really solidifies that and says if we at MISO anticipate an emergency within 12 hours, we'll start calling up those resources and saying, hey, I know, go ahead and cancel your next shift. They don't need to come in because we really think that we'll need to use your demand resource during that time. And those are the reasons why you might have a 12-hour notice is contract law and provisions that say if we're shutting down an automotive plant, they probably need 12-hour notice to allow that shift not to come in. So there's valid reasons for that, and there is value in all these resources as well. So a lot of what we'll talk about in near-term RAN changes especially are how do we make our processes better support the value of those resources. So one of the other things that Brian hit on pretty well is that we've seen recent operational risk around the conversion of capacity to energy. We're also seeing trends which increase that risk going forward. So things like the fleet change, where you have growing number of non-dispatchable resources, will increase the need for intraday flexibility to accommodate for when the sun goes down or when the wind stops blowing. Better use of demand resources, as we've seen the number of those increase. How do we make sure our rules really use those to their full capability? And even the risks and increasing reserve margin we've seen because of rising forced outage rates, driven largely by aging resources. All of these are trends that really reinforce the need to act. And so what you'll see is for resource availability need, we'll be looking at this in several stages. One of which is, how can we provide relief now? With subsequent stages being, how can we set up processes that also more holistic to provide relief into the future? And so to further that, on the next slide, we really set up four focus areas that with stakeholders that we think if we are able to tackle some of the pain points in each of these areas, that we should resolve a lot of the concerns that we're seeing today. The first is really around outage coordination processes. So a number of the emergency events we've seen in the recent past have been driven by times where we've had a lot of planned outages, namely spring and fall seasons. You have a number of outages that are planned and scheduled, and then some additional forced outages on top of that, and that's driven some of these emergency conditions. So we need to make sure that we're really supporting the schedule, those generator outage schedules, that we're providing information on how their neighboring utilities are scheduling resources so that the resources are really able to coordinate those schedules and avoid high-risk times. The second is really looking, starting with load-modifying resources and some of the questions around their requirements, but expanding them across the board to what sort of requirements do we have for resources and how do those translate into accreditation from a resource adequacy perspective? So, or putting it more simply, what do we expect of resources and what do we, and how do those requirements match up with what we expect and can receive? And that also ties into the third goal, which is looking at our resource adequacy construct. When we set it up, and even now, the risk that you generally should see is in the summer, where you have your highest loads. That's really driving your resource need and resource build out. As we increasingly move into more and more resources that are maybe more available in the fall, as we move into volatility in the spring and fall due to weather, we're seeing that risk paradigm shift. And so that will likely require a look at our resource adequacy processes to focus on more than just the summer, to focus on fall, spring, and winter resources as well. And that does two things. The one is it makes sure that we're providing information on the value of those resources that are being built throughout the year. And the second area it does is it allows for use of different resources. So there are some resources that are really winter peak resources that don't currently have a way to be capacity resources in MISO as easily today. And so having a more robust resource adequacy construct allows those resources to start participating.
So are you saying that you're looking at the seasonal construct then? Is that what that is?
Yes, it's essentially seasonal resource adequacy, or with how many seasons to be determined at this point. But we've seen a strong desire from stakeholders to move from a yearly resource adequacy construct to something that's more granular.
And so this is one thing that I've heard from OMS, and I've heard frustration, quite honestly, from other commissioners that this, they've been saying this for a long time, and MISO is enacting. So when can we expect to actually see this happening, not just kind of in a planning process?
And I think that is a valid point. What has happened is, even as long ago as the, I think it was 2005 polar vortex, we really started to drill into what are the risks outside of summer. As we spoke more and more about those, though, we realized that simply replicating our resource adequacy construct more times throughout the year probably won't resolve our concerns unless we also address how those capacity resources are converted to energy. So it has been a long journey, but what we have now, and I'll actually be talking about that next, is a path to actually address those and address them in a way that resolves the root causes, including a seasonal resource capacity construct.
So just from a high-level description, you'll basically be rating units on a seasonal, either it's two or four, however many seasons, and planning for those seasons kind of separately, correct?
So that's where some of the design details will look at it. When we've looked at this before, we might do clear all the seasons at one time, but in general, you're right. We will be looking at what's the needs for summer, for springs, for fall, winter and fall, or some stakeholders have even proposed monthly versions of that, and making sure we have resources specifically for each of those needs.
And then would each unit get a different capacity rating for the season?
Yes. And so part of the reason why we wanted to combine this with other things is there are the last goal here really talks about even if you have the right resources built, again, how are you using those and how are those resources supporting the variability within a day? And so when we think about the forward plan, and this gets directly to your question, which I sidestepped for a moment on how quickly are we moving on this, we are proposing a series of staged filings to address these resource availability and need concerns in aggregate. And these filings will actually start next week Friday, no later than next week Friday, with some targeted changes to on load modifying resources. And subsequently in January, some changes around outage coordination processes. But then they will quickly look at how do we build upon those changes to look at things like seasonal resource risk. So we will be going to stakeholders tomorrow, actually, and teeing up some of the questions on that with the ultimate goal of continuing these stage filings towards more holistic solutions, one of which we expect will be some sort of seasonal resource adequacy construct in the first half of 2020 filing and implementing in that 2021 timeframe.
Okay. Can I ask you a quick question about the number four?
Absolutely.
Sure, flexible resource availability. Maybe I'll hold it. I'll hold off. I think you might be getting to what I was saying. So.
Okay. I just provide some clarity. You just said that, I think you said tomorrow you're going to stakeholders for some information. Which stakeholders? That's a kind of broad statement. All your stakeholders and... I mean, that would be a pretty broad and long and diverse group.
So that's where we take advantage of our stakeholder process and really have public meetings, but public meeting targeted to include specific stakeholders. So to date, we've been relying on our reliability subcommittee, or RSC, and those are stakeholders that really focus in on what pain points are we having in operations. Tomorrow's meeting will focus on the resource adequacy subcommittee, which is stakeholders who for years have supported us in our resource adequacy construct through designing and improving that. So they're through public stakeholder meetings that we have these discussions.
One thing MISO has is an exhaustive stakeholder.
Exhaustive is one adjective we hear often. Fast is
exhausting.
Usually not a one we hear, though, unfortunately.
So I did want to take a little bit more time on what are we doing in the near term and how do we think those will provide benefits on the last few slides. Before I go there, are there any additional questions on how this will translate into the future? What do we expect to do next year and the year after to improve resource adequacy and resource availability and need?
The one thing I've expressed a lot and I continue to have concern about, and I've heard Claire talk a little bit about this in one or two meetings, and others from MISO, but I can't remember all their names. So in terms of sending clear signals and having resources available when they're needed, to me that gets to some of the challenges with rewarding some of these resources for the attributes that they provide to the system. Mm-hmm. And ensuring that they're available long-term when they're needed, and that the companies that own them get paid so that they have the money to invest in them and keep them, you know, from having these forced outages, et cetera. How is that fitting into this process?
So you actually pretty thoroughly described our goals for this stage three holistic solution. And stage three is really around how do we provide transparency on what we need, but then what are the incentives for it actually to occur? So when you think about the market products, we have a number of market solutions that address some of these things. But other areas like generation outage coordination are more of the reliability checks. So while we're still working on what those solutions might be, what we're really trying to do is pair more transparency and forward planning, which is really the goal of resource adequacy, with market rules to provide value to resources which have the attributes we need. So, for example, coal resources or gas resources, your typical baseload, have a number of attributes beyond the megawatts they provide. And we'll want, including ability to be scheduled ahead of the day. And so we might look at market products which help support that value.
Okay. Good. And that's the stage three.
It's a stage three. We are looking at posting a white paper which starts to talk about some of those holistic solutions as early as the first quarter of next year. And resource adequacy, since we have had some discussions on a seasonal construct, we'll be able to move on that as well.
Okay.
But there are some things we've already done, like the ramp capability product, yes, and things absolutely. Like that you know, have tried to be transitional mechanisms. So it's not like we haven't done anything in that area, but we do have products like the ramp capability product.
And that also gets to the what are we doing now versus what are we doing later. We've made some changes, and we will continue to make some changes in this upcoming filings to go and provide us enough relief to get to a holistic solution so that we can address those more thoroughly.
Okay. Thank you.
The pace here is a big question or challenge, and we heard a lot of feedback at our September board meeting from stakeholders and our board, you know, that, you know, this is urgent enough that it's worth pushing things really hard. I think there was even pretty strong agreement that that sense of urgency is there, that we ought to at least go after some of the low-hanging fruit around changes that could help now. That's why we're talking about filings this year even. Once you get down to the details of what's low-hanging and what's not, opinions differ, and those things take time to work out. So Laura's a very busy person right now trying to sort through some of that.
That's when your exhaustive stakeholder process
yes.
gets exhausting.
So just to make sure we're able to have full discussions, what we are looking at for near-term relief is really focusing on two areas. The first is back to the roughly 12 gigawatts of load-modifying resources, and establishing processes which more clearly define and focus on what they can provide. Having some comparability around resource and allowing them to, and requiring testing for these. So resources that haven't been called on multiple years would have a little bit more practice before we get to emergency events. And also improving our operational procedures to say, we see an emergency coming in 12 hours. We're going to start notifying these resources with 12-hour timelines to say, go ahead and start implementing those processes so that when we get to minute one of that emergency, we know we have the support of these. And that those are being packaged together in a set of filings which will be going out no later than next Friday. The other set of near-term changes we're looking at is around outage coordination. So I mentioned before that a number of our emergency events are occurring on times where we have a large number of planned outages. And so we wanted to step back and work with our stakeholders to see how can we forecast those, and how can we provide our generator owners a way to schedule around those. And that's the premise of our outage coordination improvements, is really incenting generators to give us more information more quickly, and then turning around and using that to improve forecasts, which can be used to schedule around high-risk times more closer to the operating day. We have heard from stakeholders that there are some concerns specifically for outages with flexibility that might be closer to that operating day that we need to work through. So while we were planning on filing that next week, we are planning on deferring that filing until January working with stakeholders to improve the filing prior to that. And that will still let us impact the spring outage season, but will give us a little bit more robust proposal to work through it.
Well, what is the... How about the changes in the shoulder season, and how that's just like there aren't as many obvious times, it doesn't seem like, for outages anymore?
And that's one of the concerns that stakeholders have raised, is that if you look at what is the best time to take outages, you can't give a uniform answer for everyone. And so that's why a lot of the focus on our process improvements have been providing more forward transparency, because the answer is the best time to take an outage is by coordinating with your neighbors and making sure it's not all at the same time.
Will the seasonal construct help with that too?
I don't know that the seasonal construct will necessarily help with that. And that's why it's only part of our holistic solution, because planned outages are something that currently, if you clear in the auction, a planned outage is a valid reason to not be available. So even as we clear seasonal resources, there's still questions around how do we make sure that they coordinate outages. Mm-hmm. So seasonal may help, because we'll know more resources that would be available in spring and fall. But there are additional tools that we'll need to use as part of that stage three holistic solution. Mm-hmm. So I will wrap on that. I broke the clicker. I will wrap on that and...
Could you advance one more?
Yeah. With my apologies to Arash for breaking his ability to forward the slides. There we go. So I'll wrap at that. I do want to quickly thank the stakeholders that are participating. I know there are several in the room who have, and OMS has been an active participation in giving us feedback and helping us to define these processes. I'm very appreciative of that, and I look forward to that as we move forward, because as we file in December, we're already moving towards how can we improve it beyond that.
Okay, and just a note here, I don't know if all presentations are similar in length, but we're halfway through the four presenters and about halfway through the slides and about two-thirds of the way through the time that was scheduled. So.
And our last topic is the flex topic here, so right. We can do that one.
And quick. Since we start a little late, could we go a little longer, too?
And I was taking that into consideration okay. That it already is a little after an hour. So.
All right.
Okay. Great. Well,
Arash, how do you spell your name?
It's A-R-A-S-H, and last name is Gatsian, in case.
How do you spell it?
G-H-O-D-S-I-A-N.
And I do have that in the last page.
Oh, okay.
It's working now.
Yeah. Ah, perfect.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, commissioners, and commission members for the opportunity to speak to you today about the MISO's generation interconnection process. Before I move forward through the slides, just a little bit of a background through the MISO's queue evolution. So kind of looking back 10 years ago, post FERC order 2003, where it was established to standardize the interconnection process for the FERC jurisdictional entities, MISO's process was formed more towards a first in, first out. And as we moved and worked our way through that, the process changed. We found opportunities to kind of look at it from different angles. And today's process is really established more around first ready, first serve. Just a high-level background on the actual process. Post-2017 queue reform, the process has been established in a way to create more certainty for the interconnection customers, and giving more certainty to transmission owners who are involved in the process. So essentially, we have a three-phase process, which takes roughly around 500 days, and including the generation and connection agreement on that as well. So through the MISO's process, prior to 2018, we have had two open door policies, and by that I mean two cycles per year, one starting in February and one in August. So looking back through the 2016-17, we've had close to 25 distinct study groups that have been going through the new interconnection process. What takes place in these different phases of the process, we have various studies internal to MISO, as well as coordination studies with the our neighbors to the east and west. So, for example, as we go with one study cycle, we're performing a number of engineering studies. We're coordinating with with SPP and PJM to determine how the neighboring footprints are being impacted as a result of the projects that are being introduced to the queue. So, again, the map to the right kind of is a representation of the different regions within the interconnection process. So we have five different regions, so west, which is Minnesota, Iowa, north and South Dakota, and then the east region, which is split into Michigan and Wisconsin, central, which consists of Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, and the southern states. Really, the biggest takeaway that we can take from this slide is that the size of the queue has been growing over the last couple of years. And that really started triggering the question. And this is not just a MISO problem. We're seeing this across the interconnect, PJM and SPP. So really that triggered the question for us as to, let's reevaluate the process, and it's not just us. SPP and PJM also have been kind of looking at their processes as well. We've been kind of coordinating on a monthly basis with the folks just to see what are the opportunities to fine-tune the current process that we have. So if we look at kind of the queue size right now, we have close to 490 projects over 80 gigawatts. So just in the 2018 cycle, we had close to 36 gigawatt of new interconnection projects added to the queue.
How do things get out of the queue besides being approved and constructed? Someone applies, you don't get them on. Is that just always just keep building, or is at some point you say that's just expired? That's not going to be possible.
So, are you referring to how do projects able to get out of the interconnection process, or
someone applies, they want to get into the system,
right?
And it's you don't think it's the best idea, or it's just unworkable at the time. Does that always just continue to linger there until they request that it be removed? It's always in the queue, or do you kind of time limit them out?
So the way that the current process works out, when a project is introduced in a cycle and we start the phase one of the process, we perform analytical studies on that, and as an outcome of that, we come up with network upgrade costs. So how much does it cost for this project to connect to the system? Whether it's a small cost or a large cost, and that's at the, typically what we've seen, for example, in the West cycle, in the 2016 February, we saw close to 55% of the megawatts withdraw from the first phase of the process.
Drop out of the process.
Withdraw, yeah. So they're out of the process because the network upgrade cost was $3.3 billion as a result of the 8-9 gigawatt that was connecting in that cycle. So, again, the way that the process is designed, we have off-ramps at between phase one and two and three, obviously with some risks being involved. But that's what the process introduces to the interconnection customers, that when they see an opportunity and if they're not ready to exit out of the process.
Arash, how much does it cost in phase one?
So current milestones for phase one is $4,000 per megawatt. That's the entry fee for a project. In addition to that, there are study deposits that are included, but they're not as significant as the...
Okay. And then for phase two, does the cost go up each step of the way as you get more serious?
No, so so the entry fee is the dollar amount per megawatt, and then as the projects progress through the different phases, it would be 10% of the network upgrade that is coming out of phase one. They would have to deposit that, and then from phase two to phase three is 20%.
On top of the 10%?
Yep.
And so a total of 30% they've paid by the time they get there.
Yeah.
Is there a phase four? No.
Nope. So phase three is the final phase, and then the projects would move into the negotiation terms.
Arash, you might want to talk about the historical percentages that we've seen different types of resources get through the queue, the percentage of wind that enters the queue versus what comes out of the queue.
Yeah, so significant amount of wind and solar, and I think that the contribution to that has been the production tax credits in the past. But typically what we've seen, at least the data on wind is roughly around 8 to 10% actually move forward and sign an interconnection agreement. And that's really what has caused us to reevaluate the process through the stakeholder process this year, which got kicked off in May. And we started to look at, there's definitely... a portion of these projects that are not ready.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we do to not necessarily discourage, because it's an open process, but really to help them perform their studies and do some additional informational analysis before they get into the interconnection process, because that only not reduces the burden on MISO, but on transmission owners and even on the regulatory staff. Because when you see a large fleet of these projects coming in and a good amount of them withdraw from phase one, so that really started the question for us, which if we can go to the next slide, please. Okay, thank you. So the things that we've done since the discussions that we've been taking place between MISO and the stakeholders, MISO stakeholders, which is transmission owners, interconnection customers, and others, kind of start to look at how can we fine-tune certain areas of the current process. Because we know the current process works, as we've seen, example, in West. Now, how can we ensure that those non-ready projects are not fleeting the process? And one of the things that we looked at had been the requirements for site control. In discussion with transmission owners and the regulatory staff, we gathered information as far as, how do we fine-tune those requirements.
Do you mean having a siting permit before they come
yes.
into the queue?
Yeah, yeah. So, the current requirement is that the interconnection customer would come in at the time of application with their site control requirements. However, we've changed that to 90 days prior to the application date. The interconnection customer would need their site control requirement. Now, unless they're running into regulatory complications. There are other avenues that, that we have introduced, cash in lieu of the for the projects that are coming in. But and we have, again, we've kind of seen that across the interconnect that folks have been kind of looking at that, and they've, you know, PJM had done something similar to this. You know, SPP has some requirements on that, which kind of we've collaborated with them to fine-tune that. The other area that we've looked at for fine-tuning is the milestones. So between every phase, as I mentioned earlier, we have a decision point where the interconnection customer can decide if they want to move forward to the next phase or not, pending on the cost, the network upgrade cost. And if they were to move to the next phase, how much of that cash would be at risk? So we've introduced percentages at each decision point for placing the cash at risk for interconnection customers moving to, you know, different phases. And the entry fee, kind of the historical data, what we have seen is the network upgrade cost has increased significantly over the last 3 to 4 years. And the approach that we've taken, and it's actually a similar approach that we came up with, the $4,000 per megawatt has been, let's look at the cost of a network upgrades over the last three phases of the cycles, completed phases of the cycles, and see and take 10% of that cost. So, and what that number has showed us is that the cost would be roughly around $10,000 per megawatt.
Using that instead of the four?
I'm sorry?
Using that for phase one instead of the
four? Yeah, so in order to get into the queue, that would be what the interconnection customer would have to submit with their application. So that's the dollars per megawatt. We've increased that. And really kind of looking at these angles, again, this we have full confidence that this will reduce the amount of non-ready projects coming in.
So
we're in the process of filing actually this Friday.
Is that a FERC filing?
Yes. Yep.
It's gone through the stakeholder process.
It has. So the stakeholder process started in May of this year, and concluded in November with the final recommendation on that. And I think the next couple of slides, if there are no questions. So the next couple of slides are more of a, I would say, informational. We're kind of looking at the Eastern Interconnect and what SPP, PJM, and the queue looks like on every angle.
You're not going to go through these one by one.
Got to get some more time. Maybe go to the next slide, please. Next slide. And Brian, I don't know if you want to tee this one up.
Yeah, Commissioner Fedorchuk, you had asked a question about the MVP, the multi-value project MVP portfolio that was launched in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of how much space, generally the question was how much space is left there. So this is a... view
this that, is your answer to that?
Pardon? The answer is not much.
This is Michael's answer to
not,
that.
Not much at all.
Sure. So I guess when we look at the table and look at the total planned wind capacity, and Laura, I know you were at MISO prior to me, but really what we've seen as far as what's in service today, we're kind of getting close to that number. I think we got close to... 17, is it 11 or
total
in service? Yep.
It's closer to 18. 17 to 18.
17 to 18 gig. Yeah. So we've when we look at the capacity again, what the multi-value projects was designed for, we've kind of reached that capacity. We're getting close to that capacity. you know, majority of the MVPs are either in service or in construction with, I believe, one in the regulatory stage. But
is the current queue process, any of them, I don't know, I need a lot more time to really dig into those five different studies, but I'm not going to. Are any of those queue studies deliberating interconnecting projects to this? Because I've had some people tell us in siting hearings that they're part of a study and they'll name the year, and that, yes, that still is for space on these lines.
So majority are, again, the majority are in service, and they're assumed as a base assumption. There may be some projects in Wisconsin area that are conditional.
Yeah, I'm not interested in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
are here.
Yeah, so in your region, there's none in the
so
West
people
region.
People are saying they're part of an interconnect for capacity that exists on the current lines, the current MVP lines. That's not true.
There could be projects that are going to be connecting the, you know, wind projects that are connecting to the MVP lines that are going through, if that's the question. There are some.
There are some that don't have an interconnection agreement yet.
There are some that are going through the study process as well. And okay. We can certainly provide that information. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the key question for, I think you probably want to ask them is, you know, do you have a generation interconnection agreement?
We do ask that, and sometimes it's yes and sometimes it's no. We're in the process, but, you know, we usually they think that there's still space available here.
It leaves you wondering how many can be in the process. Yeah,
right.
Sorry,
right.
I interrupted.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And we can certainly kind of provide you with the list if you have any specific ones that you're wondering about. I'm more than happy to kind of take that information back.
Like cutoff date, like say, you know, you've got the five different study groups, everything within the 20, like February 2016 and August 2016 are included, and anything after that isn't, or nothing that simple?
We can pull that information out.
Okay.
I don't have it with me, but we can certainly provide
whatever
you with
you
that.
Can provide for that. Okay. Thank you.
And what is the GKM for?
Those are the zoning names that was determined back in the day.
So which is which, do you know?
We don't have the map for that, so I know that map is publicly available, but we can certainly provide that information, which shows which one of these wind zones are located where.
I'm assuming that the K is the area down by Allendale where the new transmission line is coming.
You can get that to us.
Yeah. Racing for
send that,
that
to us.
Yep.
So how does the middle one, the K, when it was planned, if I'm reading this right, there was 199 megawatts, and now there's 330 still available?
That first column is the amount of total planned and active capacity when this study was done. And this study was done in early 2017. So that's what was already sort of had a GIA
taken
or was
up.
Actually generating. And there's incremental capacity that was larger than that. So you sum the two to get the total capacity. You sum those two numbers.
So where does it tell me how much is available, Brian?
For North Dakota?
Yeah. Is that over in this Callan, 0.4?
Sort of over in the call. In the call-out box, the 2.2 gigawatts of total MVP capacity for North Dakota is the sum of all those numbers that you see in yellow for North Dakota.
And 0.4 gigawatt remains.
And 0.4 is the sum of those numbers that are still in that incremental category yet to be defined. So that hasn't been consumed yet, but there are still a lot of projects in the queue that would like to consume it.
Right.
A lot more projects that would like to consume that 0.4 gigawatts than there are a space.
Okay.
So what I guess I would like to see is a list of projects that are not operational that are already accounted for in here that have been approved and are taking some of that, and then the list of applicants that you have seeking that last 4,000, the last 400 megawatts.
Mm-hmm. So for the North Dakota numbers, this all ties back to the Big Stone South to Ellendale line? Because I think that was the only North Dakota project out of the 17 in the MVP portfolio that was that 2011 that came about.
I'd like to follow up on that if that's okay. I don't have that specific information with me.
Okay, but that was the on-ramp for
okay.
a considerable amount of wind.
I believe, Allison, last you and I spoke, I think that Allendale was one.
Yes.
Well, this is the big, isn't the other one the big one from Castleton over into wherever it went in Minnesota?
Yes. I recall seeing those names when I was looking at information for Allison, but we can certainly...
Is CapEx part of the MVP portfolio?
No.
I didn't think... I saw it on the list.
Brookings.
Yeah, Brookings is, but no, I don't think CapEx was.
So...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure it's just Big Stone South to Ellendale, but
yeah.
You don't have to follow up. That's the only one that's on the list.
Yeah. So our takeaway is by project name, gigawatt or megawatts with the project, what's its status? Is it already running? Is it has a GIA and it's under construction? Is it ready to go? Or is it early? Is it in one of these farther out cycles? Sort of where is it at as related to these zones?
Yep.
Yeah.
Just as long as we can tell which ones are connected, we have the interconnected. The bottom line, I think, for us is whether it's got the interconnection agreement
mm-hmm.
and whether it doesn't.
Right.
And if you can say that it's up and running, that would be helpful too.
Sure.
And then if it's part of the group that actually has the potential to take from what's existing, what's the little bit that's left, or if it's completely outside of that.
Got it. Okay.
I mean, help me understand, but if it's not able to take in get capacity that's available, is it safe to assume there needs to be new transmission built for that project, or well, is that not?
I think that project would have to pay to have that additional capacity built. So it could still get built, but it would be very expensive.
Yeah. Like $1 billion.
And that's what we've seen in the West cycle, too. Again, it's the but-for clause. You know, we got these generators coming online, and in order to connect, there just isn't enough transmission lines, and you can't just continue patching the system. There needs to be new pipeline connecting mm-hmm. these generators to the grid. So, and when they see a significant cost, and that's when see withdrawals.
So that would leave you wondering if there should be some investigation of some sort of MVP projects.
That is a transition to the next one.
Before we get to
that, out of town.
When you're making determinations of what should be forwarded and what shouldn't be, is the current status of the project a factor, or is it just what it brings to the grid in general? And like, does it matter to you that while this is already sited? Or this one, they've already started construction in order to qualify as a 2016 project, and so we're not going to look at even a better idea now because this one's already started? Or
I guess the first step would be system reliability. That would be the most important thing to us. So whether a project wants to connect to a system, we got to make sure that it's not harming the system. And I would say in addition to that, as we go through these different phases and working with the transmission owners, that's when MISO transmission owners and interconnection customers work together to determine what's the best point of interconnection and what sort of network upgrades or transmission lines are required to connect the project to the system.
Do you guys make judgment calls on projects, whether they should or shouldn't go forward, or do you just study the costs of interconnection and say, here's what your project would cost?
That's correct, yeah.
If you want to build it, and here's the cost to interconnect to keep everything else equal, and you make the judgment call, and they decide whether to continue or not.
We show them the price tag, and they decide.
Yeah.
So you're not evaluating the merits of the project at all. You're just studying what the cost would be to interconnect it to the system.
Correct.
And the project owners make the decision to stay in the queue.
Forward, yeah.
They have to put the money forward, and it's that money that's at risk.
Correct.
But now you confused me again just when I thought I had something understood. So you have two wind farms side by side. They both apply to us. They want to build this wind farm. And because they're so close together, they each need the same amount of transmission to hook into your system. But only one of them can, because then the rest of your system would need upgrades. Don't you have to decide which one gets it and which one don't? Because for the same price of those few miles, only one of them can hook in with that. Because after that, you have other constraints.
Are those projects in the same place in the queue? In other words, are they in the same grouping? Because if they're in the same grouping, those costs would be split between the projects.
Yeah, MISO is not in any position to make decision for interconnection customers to move forward. Now, if
in one of those projects you can just hook in, and so the costs are pretty low, but if they both are going to hook in, then you need upgrades to the rest of the system.
And
it's only one of those that's really causing the additional upgrades.
Isn't it the way I understood it?
No. There is a increment. You don't want to be that last project that sort of tries to comes in right after the capacity has been consumed. You're going to be late to the party, and you're not going to. Your network upgrades are going to be dramatically higher than the project just before you.
So Randy raises an interesting point I hadn't thought about. If they come in at the same time at the same place, then the cost you would have to analyze in that round. The cost of both of them interconnecting, and then they would bear those costs. But what I understand more likely happens is maybe one comes in here, and then the next one comes in the next time, maybe they both come in, and one decides, nope, we're not going to continue. It's too expensive. They're in the same time. One says, it's too expensive. We're out. Then the next round, the costs go down for the next that project that stayed in.
And that's good. Because
now they don't have to bear the costs from interconnecting the impacts of both.
Absolutely. Yeah, and again,
so things fall out, and that's where the studies change so much. And we heard that in one of our last projects, I think, where the initial study was really expensive for interconnect, but they knew that a lot of the projects would fall off, so they stayed in, and the next time the costs went down significantly.
Right. Yeah, and then there are different scenarios, and depending on what, if a project comes in at the same time or at a different cycle, we have different cost allocation methodology for those as well. But again, it's not as straightforward.
Mm-hmm. But at no point do you guys say we like this one because it's got a shorter interconnect or whatever.
Absolutely,
you
not.
Just say here's the cost. That's it.
Burke does not let us do that.
So is there any sharing?
We're at about an hour and a half already. So I don't know if there's some.
Is there sharing between cycles at all? I mean, you put your upgrades in here, then next cycle the guy's using them. Does he have to pay back some of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, if there's a project that's benefiting from it, we determine what the megawatt impact is, and the projects would contribute to that.
I'm going to move on real quick and just try to summarize the whole transmission planning project by saying I think it's pretty obvious from the generation interconnection queue discussion that that's not the ideal way to do transmission planning. It's through the generation interconnection queue. It's better to step back and do more of an MVP type approach. And that discussion is starting. right now. In fact, the hot topic at the last board meeting last week was this very thing around the need for more regional long-term transmission planning. Page 33, if I could jump ahead into that, is, and I'll let Allison go through this, but this is a high-level summary of what that discussion had.
Well, and I know that we're short on time, and so as Brian said, the long-term transmission planning discussion is really beginning. As Jerry alluded to, this is something that needs to be talked about. So at our board meetings, four times a year, our advisory committee puts out a hot topic question, which is, goes with the name, something that is hot, some topic that people want to talk about. And our stakeholder groups put together papers and then have a facilitated discussion for a couple of hours at the board meeting. And this time last week, it was on long-term transmission planning. I put up a couple of in the slides, some of the takeaways from that discussion, which it was a very, very good discussion about the need to look at planning. We need to look broadly and have these discussions as to, do we need another round of MVPs, or is that not something that is necessarily needed? But I think the overarching comment throughout the day was, we need to study it. We need to actually do some analysis, and OMS was very involved in this, and Commissioner Fedorchuk was very involved in some of the comments that OMS put together. But another point to that was that the piecemeal approach, as Brian was saying and as others have said, isn't necessarily working. So do we want to put a Band-Aid on each step along the way, or do we want to look at the footprint? And what does that mean? Does it mean looking at the entire MISO footprint? Does it mean looking at north, south, what have you? So it was a very good discussion, but at the end of the discussion, it was, as I put on the last bullet point there, there's a need for continued conversation, and there are a lot of conversations going on. So this may be a topic as we come back for additional meetings here in North Dakota that we bring back to you, because, again, being out of time, and also the beginning of these discussions. So, and then the one other topic very quickly that ties to that is when we're doing transmission planning, then who pays for the costs? And as Brian alluded to, we've had a couple of years worth of stakeholder process that Carolyn has been very involved in on determining the cost allocation, whether the costs and benefits tie as they should as things have changed in the industry, as our MISO footprint has changed as well. And we are going to be making a filing. Our plan is by the end of this, by the end of 2018, to make the regional cost allocation filing. They're working really hard between MISO and the TOs to get that filing put together. And that filing looks at the costs of lowering the market efficiency project cost allocation to the 230 kV level, aligning the transmission voltage classes across the footprint, but also some really good stakeholder work that put together a new category called the local economic projects, which clarifies that cost allocation treatment of local projects under the 230 kV level. And then separately, we have just put in a request for an extension of the filing of our interregional cost allocation. We put that in December 6th, hoping for an answer by December 28th. So that we can put that interregional cost allocation filing in by April 30th. That is cost allocations for projects really that are on the seams, and getting that cost allocation aligned also consistent with the RTO seams. So that's where we sit. I know we're a little bit over time. I can certainly offline answer any questions unless you have questions right now.
Any closing?
No. I appreciate these conversations. It's really helpful to keep them on the calendar. I know this one slipped a few different times, but I think it's really good to keep you in front of all of us so that we're all up to speed. And thanks for getting the team together and providing information on the subject matter that we requested. So appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess two things for me. Sometime in the future, and maybe it's a one-on-one or at a future meeting, I'm curious, are there any studies out there that indicate the impact on our economy to to demand response usage. Certainly, you mentioned the auto plant getting shut down and needing 16 hours of notice because of their contracts. Well, there's an impact to the economy when that's how we keep our electric system going, by shutting down, too. So I'd like to know whether that's ever been studied and how far we want to go with that. And secondly, if maybe Carolyn and Allison would give me a minute here, and a question where I was confused earlier, but we don't have to take everybody's time on it. Thank you.
Thank you.